Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report, special Friday edition for February 6th, 2014. On today's show, the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest releases the final environmental impact statement of the big one, Clear Creek Forest Restoration Project. We'll hear some objections from outside the collaborative process, but first, this news. The Idaho Millennium Fund Committee yesterday recommended approval of a $500,000 grant to the Idaho Association of Counties that would provide startup money for four peer-oriented substance abuse and mental illness recovery centers around the state. If the Millennium Fund grant gets final approval from the legislature, $125,000 of the money would go towards starting a recovery center in Latah County. The legislature's Joint Finance Appropriations Committee will consider the Millennium Fund Committee's recommendations at 10 a.m. Mountain Time Monday. The Lewiston Tribune reports all three Latah County commissioners, Dave McGraw, Richard Walzer, and Tom Lamar, spent a week in Boise advocating for the Recovery Center grant. The committee decided the four recovery centers proposed by the Idaho Association of Counties would be among the dozen projects they recommended for funding. The Millennium Fund considered 19 applications for funding. Senator Dan Johnson of Lewiston and Senator Dan Schmidt of Moscow are both on the Millennium Fund committee. The $125,000 for recovery centers in Ada, Canyon, Gem, and Latah counties, totaling $500,000 statewide, would cover first-year startup costs, including 1 year's pay for a center director and volunteer coordinator. Lamar told the paper, "There's just a lot of support for this proposal, and it's nice to see the state respond this way." Daryl Keim of the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare had said earlier there would likely be enough financial and in-kind support to start a recovery center in Moscow, even without the grant, but with the startup money, the center would likely be up and running more quickly and with less difficulty. Keim has taken the reins on trying to get the recovery center going in Moscow. Keim has said, "The idea is to have people who are further along in the recovery assist staff in helping those who need more help because they are in the early stages of recovery." A Washington legislator is proposing a bill that would relocate some of the state's wolves to the Southern Cascades. Republican Representative Joel Kretz of Wakanda, who represents the northeastern corner of Washington, says 11 of the state's 14 wolf packs are in his district, where he says they cause conflicts with ranchers and other residents. Wildlife officials say the most ideal habitat for the state's wolves would be the Southern Cascade Mountains, where they are expected to migrate on their own by the year 2022. However, Kretz wants to speed up the process by relocating about 20 wolves to other parts of the state. The Associated Press reported last year Kretz sponsored a bill to relocate eastern Washington wolves to the legislative districts of lawmakers who are supportive of returning wolves. While wildlife officials and environmental groups agree the wolves would likely prefer to live in the Southern Cascades, they say it's best to let wolves find their way there on their own. Wolves were wiped out in Washington in the 1990s, but in the past 15 years, they have been slowly moving back into the state from Idaho and British Columbia. Under Washington's wolf recovery plan, there would have to be at least 15 breeding pairs spread across different areas of the state in order to cut back on some of the restrictions on killing wolves. The Washington Fish and Wildlife Department estimated there were at least 52 wolves in the state at the end of 2013. Washington legislators are considering a bill that would require schools to teach Native American history. The bill is a beefed-up version of one passed in 2005, which encourages, rather than requires, schools to teach Native American curriculums. Since 2005, just three of Washington's 295 school districts, along with a few individual schools, have opted to include Native American education in their history or social studies programs. Spokane Confederated Tribes Language Program Manager Marsha Weinkoop has been working with Democratic Senator John McCoy of Tulalip and former Governor Gary Locke to develop the new law. She told the Daily News tribal members see the latest move as a positive step, but in addition to changing the curriculum, teachers need to be more culturally competent. Weinkoop said the tribe will continue to work with schools to incorporate tribal history and culture components into their classrooms, regardless of the outcome of the latest legislation. Next month, the tribe will host a Native American education symposium that will show teachers how to work with Native American students. Washington legislators yesterday held a hearing on a proposal that would make the state the first to ban the keeping of whales, dolphins, and porpoises to be used in SeaWorld-type performances. The bill, sponsored by Democratic Senator Kevin Rankin of Orcas Island, is aimed at preventing future exploitation of animals, as there currently are no porpoises or dolphins on display in the state. Opponents of the law say it would limit research opportunities and take away the chance for children to see orcas and dolphins. The proposed law follows a failed proposal in California last year that would have even required SeaWorld to release its killer whales. The Washington Health Exchange reported yesterday it is 81,000 people short of its enrollment goal for the program, with about a week remaining in sign-up for this year. Officials with the state exchange reported 87,528 residents renewed their insurance through the state exchange, and another 44,000 have purchased new insurance through the exchange during the current sign-up period. We now turn to a featured segment. The Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest yesterday released the final environmental impact statement on the Clear Creek Timber Project near Kuski. The plan targets trees the Forest Service says are fire-prone and close in age on 44,000 acres and will replace them with a mix of old and young stands. The final environmental impact statement says logging the 85 million board feet over a 5 to 10-year period would reduce the chance of insect infestation and large catastrophic fires and improve habitat for animals, including elk. Moose Creek District Ranger Joe Hudson told the Lewiston Tribune, "We are using timber harvest to create what this area would have been like if fire had not been taken out of the area. Through obtaining those desirable outcomes on the landscape, we will produce jobs and wood for the local community." Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest Project Coordinator Mike Ward said the openings created in the forest under the plan will have irregular shapes. Ward told the paper the concept of the 1960s-era postage stamp clearcut is not what we are trying to achieve. The collaborative says the project will help maintain 1,200 jobs over a 5 to 10-year period. Bill Higgins of the Grangeville-based Idaho Forest Group, who is a member of the Clearwater Collaborative process, which came up with the timber sale, said, "I've affectionately called it the big one for a number of years. It's a critical landscape-level planning and project that is going to benefit the local economy greatly." Members of conservation groups involved in the collaborative say agreeing to the timber project would help the environmental community get support from the timber industry and local governments for wilderness proposals in the area that could add 300,000 acres to the nation's wilderness system. Brad Brooks of the Wilderness Society in Boise said the project will help habitat. He said, there is a lot of stuff in here, but it's a science-based approach to forest management, and it's going to include a lot of good conservation work as well, a lot of good road work and aquatic work. On balance, this is a package we can support. Groups and individuals who commented on the draft environmental impact statement are eligible to file objections within 45 days to the final EIS. Gary McFarlane of the Moscow-based Friends of the Clearwater said his group will file a formal objection. I spoke with McFarlane this afternoon.
We have the Nez Perce Clearwater Forest Project Coordinator saying the harvest will have ragged edges. So 60s-style postage stamp clear cuts are a thing of the past. How does that impact habitat?
Well, what they have now are 21st century style clear cuts, which from every single measure, with maybe the exception of a few trees left here and there, is essentially the same from an ecological perspective, from a watershed perspective, and from a wildlife perspective. It's going to be the same as a clear cut. So it's going to be a clear cut, and it's going to look like a clear cut.
The two sentences that you were quoted in at the end of the article in the Lewiston Tribune today said Friends of the Clearwater will file formal objections. They have some concerns. And then the second sentence listed three concerns: fish habitat, water quality, and cumulative impacts of the timber harvest on adjacent private land and Forest Service land and wildlife. Is that a complete list?
Oh, no, it's not a complete list. I only had a chance to give a few examples, and obviously the article was focused more on the proponents of this project rather than looking at some serious problems. The whole conception of this, following the money, the Forest Service has been giving money to this organization called the Clearwater Basin Collaborative, which is a little bit fishy in our mind, and it may violate the Federal Advisory Committee Act. We've got concerns with the analysis of this. Was it done fairly? And taking a look at some of those concerns, like water quality, the Forest Service is not meeting its forest plan standards in this area already. How they can go and do this project and still meet the forest plan standards really is baffling. We don't think it's based on the best science. In fact, it's not. It's based simply on a political backroom deal.
And you're concerned about fish in the area that are an important part of the ecosystems then?
Well, absolutely. We're going to be looking at several concerns, including anadromous fish. Those are ones that come back from the ocean, things like steelhead and salmon. We're also going to be looking at bull trout. They didn't really even look for them in the project area, saying, well, we didn't find them low down, but they may be in the headwater streams. So those are some issues that we're looking at in terms of fish habitat. In terms of water quality, are they meeting, again, the forest plan standards? They don't have recent data to suggest that they do. So we've got some serious concerns with this, and the size of it, 85 million board feet, is a huge timber sale for this area. They're basically going to be altering this area significantly, and certain species of wildlife are going to be end up being the losers, such as species that need older forests. Those are not going to do well from this project, because their habitat, the ones that depend on older forests, is going to be gone, basically clear cut.
Name a couple of those species.
Well, things like fisher, things like goshawks, things like pileated woodpeckers. Those are three in particular.
Those are listed?
They're not listed, but there is a petition to list the fisher as an endangered species. All three, I believe, are management indicator species on the Nez Perce National Forest in their current forest plan. So those are ones that are indicative of older forests, and their habitat has been declining, and we don't have good numbers. In fact, the Forest Service doesn't have numbers at all for those species. It only has general habitat numbers, and basically their philosophy is, well, if there's habitat over the ridge, it doesn't matter what we do here.
If my memory is correct, in the past, the Friends of the Clearwater has had the position that the collaborative processes violate such federal laws as the National Forest Policy Act and the National Forest Planning Act and things like that.
Yeah, our concern is that it violates the National Environmental Policy Act, specifically in that a deal or an agreement is made before the analysis is done, and that violates NEPA. It says that you have to do an analysis and involve the public. That means everybody, not just a few people in a cabal, prior to making a decision. And in essence, what they've done with this project is they made a decision that they were going to do it before they even asked the public of what they thought and before they even did any analysis of the environmental impacts. Thus, the environmental impacts analysis was shoehorned into an already made decision, and so we think they are scientifically suspect in terms of impacts because they wanted to minimize and downplay them. And we're going to question seriously the so-called science behind this decision.
Environmental groups are involved with this Clearwater collaborative process. Brad Brooks of the Wilderness Society in Boise was quoted as saying there's good conservation work, good road work, and aquatic work involved in that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there are some good things that they will be doing, but I don't know if that will mitigate for the damage they will be doing by building more roads and having such a massive timber sale. So those are some things that are supposedly good, but every single timber sale that the Forest Service puts up now, they close a few roads and saying, hey, we're restoring the place. Not one area has been shown to have been recovered under that management strategy up here in the Clearwater Basin, because the Forest Service hasn't done their job, first of all, and even monitoring, so we don't have the data. But the data that are available suggest that this is a failed management strategy.
Also, the environmental groups involved in the collaborative process say getting support from the timber industry and local governments this project will help get support from local governments and the timber industry for future wilderness legislation. Is this different from the Boulder White Cloud? And you're talking about places in the Idaho County area, and what are they talking about there?
Well, they're talking about their little agreement that they reached, which really isn't wilderness. They agreed a couple years ago to recommend some very limited wilderness for an area that was called Kelly Creek or the Great Burn, and for part of Meadow Creek and some of Mallard Larkin's.
This is the NPC National Forest?
Yeah, Meadow Creek is on the Nez Perce portion of the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forests. Mm-hmm. And the other three areas that would be added, there's a little bit, a tiny bit of addition to the Selway Bitterroot up and around Elk Summit. There would be some acreage in the Kelly Creek Great Burn area that was not determined as of yet. They still have not agreed to final boundaries there. And then there was some acreage up on in the Mallard Larkins. But it was minimal compared to the roadless base on these two forests. There's 1.5 million acres, and they recommended about 20%. And the important thing is it's not real wilderness because they have exceptions in there that are contrary to the Wilderness Act, like allowing outfitters and guides to have permanent structures and allowing state fish and game to basically do whatever they want to do in terms of motor vehicles and take them in there to quote-unquote manage wildlife, which means basically going in and killing wolves.
And these wilderness recommendations are also coming out of the collaborative process, Clearwater Collaborative?
Yes, they came out with their recommendation on these, like I said, about a year and a half ago or so.
Okay. Friends of the Clearwater's position is that they, as a group, were never asked to join the Clearwater Collaborative?
That is right. We were never formally invited. We maybe could have forced ourselves into the process, but this is not the legitimate process to become involved. The legitimate process is the National Environmental Policy Act, when every citizen has an equal say. This, again, is a political backroom process.
And I understand that there are concerns about collaborative processes in general, and I've heard about several in Eastern Oregon where environmentalists were involved and then tried to block things that they felt were not environmentally sound, and their objections were ignored. They ended up quitting?
Yes. The collaborative processes haven't operated, in my mind, very ethically. None of them have. For example, on this Clearwater Basin Collaborative, one group, Idaho Rivers United, that used to be part of it, was asked to leave because they filed a lawsuit against the Forest Service. And so they were asked to leave, yet lawsuits...
On a separate issue.
On a separate issue, that is right. On
megaloads.
On megaloads, the megaload issue, they were asked to leave. Yet, Idaho and Clearwater counties filed a lawsuit on the Clearwater National Forest travel plan. They were not asked to leave.
My understanding with the Idaho Rivers United is they offered to leave because of the lawsuit.
Oh, well, they did, but they were also asked to leave.
Oh, really? Okay.
They were asked to leave, and I think it was sort of mutual. Let me put it this way. There was coercion there, I think. They were put in an uncomfortable position because they did. Yet the same treatment, whether they offered or not, the same rules were not applied to the two county commissions. So I find that ethically questionable.
Anything else you'd like to add about this Clear Creek timber sale, which came out of the Clearwater Collaborative, that the final environmental impact statement was issued yesterday by the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest?
Well, it's a huge sale. It's massive. 85 million board feet is about the size, as I recall, of the infamous Cove and Mallard timber sales put together. So this is a very large. It could have a very significant impact, and we're taking a very close look. We have 45 days in which to file objections. The Forest Service has not made a decision. Objections are a legitimate part of the process as it currently exists. And so we intend to avail ourselves of that, and I suspect there will be other organizations that will be joining us in the objection process.
That was Gary McFarlane of Friends of the Clearwater speaking in the Radio Free Moscow studios this afternoon. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report, and this is KRFP Moscow Pullman Community Radio for the Palouse. We now have an excerpt from the January 14th meeting on coal and oil trains at Sandpoint City Hall. The meeting was called to educate on the issue of the expected sharp increase in oil and coal trains through Sandpoint. The increases are due to the oil industry's use of rail to deliver Bakken crude oil from North Dakota to West Coast terminals and refineries, as well as the expected increase in coal shipments from the Powder River coal basin in eastern Montana and northern Wyoming to West Coast terminals for shipment to Asia. Much of that increase would come about if the proposed Tongue River Railroad to the coal fields is built in eastern Montana. This excerpt is from Sandpoint community advocate Gary Payton, who spoke at the January 14th meeting.
When we look at the full build-out of the coal export terminals, both in Washington State and additional expansion in British Columbia, the daily movement could actually increase to as many as 27 trains. Those trains currently move along the MRL line, so they enter our Bonner County through Clark Fork, move through East Hope, Kootenay, Ponderay, Sandpoint, on south across the bridge through Athol and on south until they finally get through the funnel and enter into the state of Washington. The key point here is that there are capacity limitations for those coal trains moving on the MRL line. So it's postulated that if at capacity, there would be additional coal train movements up onto the High Line, the BNSF line that would move along through Boundary County and then south on the BNSF line. Shifting briefly then from an overview of the coal circumstance and taking a looking at oil, the reason that the oil conversation is so topical for us right now is because of the rapid, significant expansion of the oil development in the Bakken fields in North Dakota and northeastern Montana. For us locally, as those trains transit through here, The important piece is that there are significant planning right now being done to expand oil refineries and terminals in Washington State. Each one of those dots that you see on that chart has an ongoing process right now within the state of Washington. There's also the likelihood that in the upcoming Congress in Washington, D.C., there's a probability of the lifting of the years-long ban on the export of crude oil from the United States. As the United States continues to move toward energy independence and with the increasing supply of oil produced in the country, making it available internationally. To service each one of those anticipated refineries or terminals would once again require those oil trains moving through the Sandpoint area. When we look at the full range of those terminals, we can anticipate a potential doubling or even tripling of the oil train transports moving through our local area. It could be up to 22 additional, that's loaded and empty, oil trains per day coming through our area. As the mayor indicated a few moments ago, we can get a feel for the relative increase that we're seeing with the baseline of around 10 or 15 in June up to 18 to 21 now moving through on a regular basis, with the anticipation that will only increase next year and the year beyond. A few months ago, an organization called Sightline Institute did a major analysis of the potential delays at grade crossings throughout the entire oil train route through North Idaho and on into Washington up to receiving at these particular terminals. You're going to hear a little bit more about the potential economic impact within Bonner County and Sandpoint of delays at crossings from Mr. Jared Yost, who will be following me. So once again, we're talking about the potential here of the cumulative impact of increased oil, increased coal trains that some have projected could amount to as many as 5 hours of additional delays at some of our individual crossings. And that does not include the baseline traffic that we now see in intermodal traffic as well, the other kind of rail traffic that moves through the area. There are opportunities, though, for elected officials and us as citizens to be able to weigh in and have a voice in this overall process. Mayor Logan indicated just a few moments ago that 2 cents worth opportunity was created by the fact that there is a expanded rail proposal now on the table in the state of Montana. The organizing entity, the reviewing entity, is the Department of Transportation's Surface Transportation Board. They have the responsibility for reviewing any new rail line. So what we're talking about here is the Tongue River Railroad in Montana, which is being designed to carry additional coal to both Pacific Northwest terminals as well as Midwest terminals. And I'd like to correct a data point that we've read recently in the Bee. The new line that we're talking about here would facilitate the movement of 20 million tons per year from the Otter Creek mine, but the impact for us would be included in these totals would be at least 14 trains per day, loaded and empty, likely to serve those newer expanded ports on the West Coast, whether it be in BC or whether it be in Washington State. The important piece of this is that the Surface Transportation Board had stated that it will consider downline impacts upon communities through which the coal trains will move. That creates the opportunity then for elected officials to request a hearing, to request that their voice be heard about the local impacts to be held, to be able to have conversations about mitigating costs for overpasses or underpasses or improved at-grade crossings, to be able to have conversations about the cost impacts of all of these things. To date, the cities of Livingston, Billings, Missoula, Montana, Sandpoint, the Bonner County Commissioners, and Spokane, Washington, have requested that hearings be held in our region, not just within the state of Montana, on the issue of the expansion of the Tongue River Railroad.
That was Sandpoint Community Advocate Gary Payton speaking at the January 14th meeting on coal and oil trains at the Sandpoint City Hall. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, 90% chance of rain tonight, low 41, south winds 5 to 15, gusts to 22 miles an hour. Tomorrow, 100% chance of rain, high 56, breezy, southwest winds 5 to 10, increasing to 15 to 20 in the afternoon with gusts up to 40 miles an hour. And Saturday night, 60% chance of rain, mainly before 10 p.m., mostly cloudy, low 40, south winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 20. On Sunday, 80% chance of rain, mainly after 4 p.m., high 52. And 80% chance of rain Sunday night, low 42, 60% chance of rain Monday, cloudy, high near 50. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the Radio Free Moscow website to find out more ways to help Radio Free Moscow. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a pleasant weekend. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial.